I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. The SR-71 Blackbird still holds the records for highest and fastest flying manned aircraft and served in the US Air Force until 1998.
I do find it remarkable that an aircraft built in 62, now in 2014, still holds every speed and altitude record.
SR-71 pilot Brian Shull is speaking at the International Women in Aviation Conference in Lake Buena Vista this week. I'll talk to him about his career in aviation and what it was like to pilot the world's fastest spy plane. But first, the state legislative session begins this week. To preview the upcoming legislative agenda and look at other political issues impacting Florida, I'll speak with 90.7's political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined by 90.7 political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. Dick Batchelor is a former Democratic State House representative. He's also the founder and president of the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Dick, welcome back to the program.
Great to be back. Thank you.
And, of course, Lou Fry, a former Republican congressman. He is the founder of the Lou Fry Institute for Politics and Government at the University of Central Florida. Lou, very nice to have you back.
Good to be here.
Well, folks, there's a lot to get through in this segment. Of course, we're looking at the legislative session starting up. Gun control, one big issue that's coming up in the legislative session, highlighted by an NRA-backed bill that would broaden Stand Your Ground law and would allow someone to brandish a firearm and fire a warning shot to scare away an attacker. Lou Fry, in a time where it seems like there's an outcry from some quarters at least for stricter gun control, what do you think is the momentum to get these kinds of bills through the Florida legislature?
I think it's difficult, no matter what side of the bill you're on. I think this bill is a great example of how a bill has got good supporters and everything, but it doesn't have the broad support it needs to win. And I think that's probably what's going to happen to the bill. It isn't going to go through.
Dick Batchelor, do you think that the verdict in that recent trial up in Jacksonville, the Michael Dunn trial, would have some kind of impact on getting legislation like this or other similar bills passed?
You would think it would. You would think it would cause some caution to go back and revisit Stand Your Ground, but now there's a new bill that's been filed that basically allows you to discharge or brandish a firearm in some kind of a fire warning shot or whatever, and I'm not sure that makes it even more difficult because it really gives people an opportunity to whip that gun out. So Stand Your Gun is a difficult one. In a Dunn case, though, you would think they would go back and revisit it. And depending on the conviction in that, whether or not they convict on appeal on first-degree murder or not, but he still has three convictions on second degree. And so you would think it would cause him to go back and revisit Stand Your Ground.
Lou Fry, I feel like sometimes when we talk about these issues, it's a bit broken record. But are we in the same situation now? Should we, you know, asking that question, will lawmakers go back and revisit Stand Your Ground? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think they ought to revisit it. I really do. I think it's an important issue. It's not going to go away. It's one that's obviously got a lot of problems all over the place, but you just can't ignore it. Mm-hmm. And at least by getting it out and people talking about it and legislators talking about it all over the state, we may get a better chance of getting something done.
I think you have some tweaks to it. Senator David Simmons, who sponsored the original Stand Your Ground in the Senate, has said he's open to some kind of changes based on the Trayvon Martin case. There will not be substantial changes to it. There might be some tweaks to it, but it would be very interesting to see the new bill moving through where you can actually pull out a firearm and discharge the firearm just as a warning shot, how that plays into it. To me, it gets looser and looser.
Moving on, House Speaker Will Weatherford's placing focus on legislation to protect children, specifically looking at institutions like the Department of Children and Families, and lawmakers are proposing overhauls to the DCF after Secretary David Wilkins resigned amid controversy over the effectiveness of the department. Dick Batchelor, are you glad to see the legislature stepping in so quickly to try and remedy the child welfare system?
Finally, there have been 400 deaths in the state of Florida and little children, and you've got to look at the laws, and you've got to look at one of the issues of primacy. Is it the issue of primacy to reunite the child with the family, or is the issue of primacy what is the best interest of the child? And that's the philosophical divide. And we've got to go back and put the onus on the department and the judges really not to place these children back in harm's way. That's why we end up with serious abuse cases and deaths in so many cases. and the judicial system has got to respond to that.
Is this an easy fix, though, do you think?
It's not an easy fix. It's very complicated, but fortunately in the governor's budget, and I applaud him on this, he's adding 400 new child protection workers. The ratio right now is like 1 to 15. It's almost impossible to manage that kind of a caseload if you get it down 1 to 10. So at least I applaud the governor and the Republican leadership if they fund those 400 new child protection workers.
Yeah, and if they train them, right, and not just throw them in to get the numbers.
Right.
Part of the thing is it's a catch-up deal, so you're reaching out and grabbing anybody who has anything to do with it, and I'm not so sure you're getting the product that right. you and I both want.
Well, that's a good point Lou makes, and that is one senator is actually filing a bill concurrent with this that actually require going forward that the child protective workers have a master's in social work or at least a background in psychology and social work rather than just taking somebody who has no training in that area. So that would be a good thing.
Lou Frey, since you brought up that point, I mean, does it surprise you that it's taken this long to get to this point with requiring the kind of that kind of education level for people working in this field?
Unfortunately, no. I wish I could say I really was surprised about it because it's an area we all care about. It's not something that we just turn away from. But it's so emotional, and people really are having a hard time taking a step back to see, is this really a step forward, and can we really make a difference, and will this change a system which badly needs changing? And you can't just talk about it. You got to actually do something.
What about the universities? How do you think they'll react to this?
You mean the training?
Yeah, training.
Training. Oh, yeah, I think they didn't probably invite it.
Yeah, they would surely be involved in the training part of it, and it's a it'll be a good thing.
Healthcare is another big issue that the state lawmakers are going to be discussing over the next couple months. And much to the surprise of both you, Lou Frey, and Dick Batchelor, lawmakers didn't pass a Medicaid expansion, nor did they call a special session to deal with the issue. And now we have state Democrats vowing to bring up the so-called $51 billion elephant in the room. Lou Frey, do you think Republican lawmakers in the state need to address Medicaid expansion?
I think everybody's got to look at Medicaid expansion, and this thing has been around. How many times have we talked about it and voted on it?
Yep.
Huh? Plenty.
It's plenty, a lot of times, and it's one of these issues that I don't think is going to be a big divider at the end of it. I think people have got their political parts. They're going to take their shots at it, and then maybe they'll come up with some legislation that can be voted on by both sides.
Dick Batchelor, do you think the fact that we have kind of growing pains with the online marketplaces, with the Affordable Care Act being rolled out, is that having some kind of impact, or will it have an impact on the direction the legislature takes with addressing Medicaid expansion?
I think it weakens the position of those arguing for Medicaid expansion, unfortunately, even though it's not directly related, but I think the Republicans will use that. The $51 billion elephant in the room happens to be the Republicans standing in the way of Medicaid expansion. And it would get us $51 billion over 10 years. That costs the state less than $2 billion. We'd cover 700,000 people, a great number who are young people. But what they're doing instead is they're cutting Medicaid. They're cutting it to the hospitals, so Jackson Memorial and others are having their Medicaid reimbursements lowered, and they're going to run budget deficits on Medicaid. And so we're not really solving the problem. And the fact is people are going to get health care. They're going to go to the emergency room, and it's called cross-subsidization. We who have insurance are going to pay for that. So in the end, we're going to pay either way. So it's really unreasonable that the legislature will not fund Medicaid.
Mm-hmm. We've got a $1.3 billion surplus.
Right.
And there's a lot of money out there that people have all sort of good programs, and you're seeing it's like a Christmas tree. All of a sudden, this program jumps up and just so happens to be involved with that congressman's district or legislator's district, but that's all right. Good issues. There's a lot of good things. You're going to pick between a lot of good bills, and there's going to be – that's where the fighting is going to go.
Right.
And that's – everybody's going to want their own thing and their own part of the pie, and – that and so it's nothing unusual.
You know, you're saying
Governor Scott
Christmas
is like
tree,
Santa
right?
Claus in that scenario.
Yeah, and not just he's not the only one. People are dropping stuff on his legislation.
I mean, it's election year too, of course. Do you think there's any kind of blowback from this if this Medicaid expansion issue isn't addressed this year?
I think it's a good issue for the Democrats. I mean, to not do Medicaid expansion is a good Democratic issue on health care. Again, it gets muddled in the whole debate about Obamacare and open markets and that kind of thing, but it is a good issue.
Mm-hmm. Staying with you, Dick Batchelor, ethics reform was a headlining issue last year. Leaders are hoping to include more ethics legislation this year's session to create a cleaner government. Are you looking to any other major overhauls this session?
I think that one of the big things they're trying to work out now, which I don't think is an ethics question, is as a residency. You know, where do you live if you're a senator? There's some controversy about one or two senators, where they, whether or not they live in their own districts. But any kind of ethics reform is always invited and welcome in Tallahassee. I know on the other side of the coin, there you've got some legislators who are proposing legislation that would lift a gift ban and allow a lobbyist will once again buy you dinner and stuff. But I don't see those things going. I think the political environment we're in now is ethics driven. So I think any kind of new ethics legislation has a very good chance of passing.
Yeah, and we are looking towards an open voting society, if you will, where it's not as much as you give, but people know what you're giving. And that's really the critical part. And they've come, there's been some real progress made on it. There's a way to go, but that's an issue as a member of the legislature. You probably want to wrap yourself around. You know, the one of the Fry rules, if you got to explain you're in trouble, you don't have to explain why you're getting tougher legislation in terms of what you've, who gave you the money and where it went.
Back in the old days, as it were, back in the 70s, I sponsored legislation on financial disclosure, number one, and number two, limiting the gift you could get from lobbyists. I was told I was a socialist, but it passed. And the history has borne out that the more ethics, the more transparent government is, the more people welcome it.
That label gets thrown out around a little too willy-nilly.
Oh, it won't be the first time I've heard it.
You're listening to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm speaking to 90.7's political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. You can join the conversation online on Facebook or Twitter. You can also send us an email, intersection@wmfe.org. Pro sports franchises didn't fare too well last legislative session, despite the shortfall, though. Major League Soccer franchises like the one in Orlando and also David Beckham's in Miami will be lobbying the legislature for tax incentives this year. Lou Fry, do you think tax dollars should be going to these franchises, or should they be completely privately funded?
Well, we'd love to see them all privately funded. I don't know if you're going to get it. So the answer is, how much are you willing to move to get Beckham to put a 25,000-seat stadium down there, and how much money will it bring in? I really believe that sports are a very good economic driver, and if you can get them in the right way, I think it makes an awful lot of sense. There's always the fight of who's going to pay for it. And what usually happens if it works is everybody pays a little bit. And I think that that's a good thing. I think Florida ought to be not only the sports capital of the United States, but ought to be the family capital of the United States. And I think if you're going to spend money for other stuff, I'd rather see it done for the sports things than I would for casinos.
So not the gambling capital of the United States.
No, not the gambling capital of the United States.
And I think you two agreed on that.
We agreed.
And just back to the soccer, do you think it's likely that soccer will be grouped in with some of the other tax breaks that pro baseball, football, and basketball teams get?
Pretty hard to say why they won't be. Soccer is the biggest sport in the world, except for here and that. And if it's a legitimate thing and it's in the balance sheet shows that it makes sense, why not? And Orlando's a great place. I tried to get, just to give you an example, over the west coast of Florida, my grandson's playing for a team in Washington, the Hoyas, Georgetown. And so we thought we'd go see him over there. And it's a month from now, couldn't get a place to stay. Yeah. Literally could not get a place to stay over there. And they don't have a major league team. They're working with minor league teams, right, a whole bunch. And just a wonderful economic boom for them over there. So it really does make a difference. You know, the other nice thing about soccer is women can play. Yep. And that's really made a difference, too. So the families really get involved. Yeah, I think it's a good thing.
Traditionally, what has happened is that the sports teams usually got a sales tax rebates from the monies they generated. So they would get $2 million a year, you know, maybe over 30 years. And that was the, quote, public's contribution to the teams. Keep in mind, last year, the Miami Dolphins wanted to expand, and the Speaker of the House stopped it. And now they've got a piece of legislation that basically creates, I'm going to call it an Office of Economic Development, whereby you apply to this office to see if you qualify for the sales tax money. And as Lou indicated, one, what is the economic impact? Not just because you have the political influence like NASCAR to get the money put in the budget, but can you prove an economic, what is the economic driver? Is it an economic impact? Is it a plus? And what percentage of it should be publicly funded? So I think that's kind of new in the speaker.
It's an agreement made to be gone back and forth on. It's not an easy thing, but I think you're going to have everybody play in the thing if it's going to go anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not port building. It's not just which delegation has the most political influence. Maybe you should have some proof, going through the process to prove that you merit this sales tax money.
Taking a look at county politics now in Orange County specifically, we have Commissioner Fred Brummer in a memo to County Mayor Teresa Jacobs outlining a plan to make numerous changes to the county's charter, including upping the number of commissioners from 6 to 8, ending the election of a tax collector, and also upping the amount of petitions needed to get an ordinance on the ballot. He's facing a bit of pushback there, of course. He wants this done via mail-in election in May, and that would be estimated to cost about $1.7 million. Dick Batchelor, what do you think is going on here? What's the motivation behind these changes?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, I mean, some of his recommendations were before the Charter Review Committee but did not make it onto their list of things to get done. But if you want to expand the number of commissioners to 6 so you could accommodate a Hispanic commissioner, that seems to be has some appeal to it. What seems to be going on behind the scenes, though, is there's a fight going on with Scott Randolph, who is the tax collector. And one of the provisions, as you know, is to do away with his office, his constitutional office, which I oppose because, frankly, I like constitutional officers. I think they should be all nonpartisan, but I like constitutional officers because government closer to the people serves best, and so I have no problem with keeping a constitutional officer. But that's some of the behind-the-scenes politics that's going on there. It's really not about minority commissioners. It really is about can we get rid of the tax collector's office, who happens to be, by the way, a Democrat.
Mm-hmm. Lou Fry, what are your thoughts on that? Should that office stay or should it go?
I agree. I think it should be it's an office. It's worked pretty well. It's elected by the people. It gives you a chance to complain or not complain. And I think that's good. I think what you're seeing now, though, is sort of a legislative here it is, here it isn't kind of deal. You put a thing out. There's a whole bunch of things you put out knowing that they all won't go through. But out of that whole bunch is 5 or 6 or 7 things. There's usually 1 or 2 things you really want. And the others just camouflage.
Well, it's just,
but Fred's a good guy. He's done a good job people take him seriously.
I think one thing they could do is take it back before the Charter Review Commission and maybe have them look
good
at
idea.
It and bring it and put it back on the ballot. You don't want to spend $1.7 million in a special election and mail-in ballot in May and then go to an August primary election, put it on the ballot in primary season or the general election.
Well, is there any kind of precedent for these kinds of mail-in elections in county history?
Yeah, they have been. I think the last one, I think the last one is the one they tried to do these tax for transportation. I think that was a mail-in ballot and didn't fare very well.
Mm-hmm. One of the opponents to this idea of, for example, upping the amount of petitions needed to get an ordinance on the ballot has been some folks from the sick time initiative. How does that sick time initiative issue play into this whole debate?
The threshold is pretty high now. I believe you need about 70,000 signatures to get an issue on the ballot, which is a pretty high threshold. It's a certain percentage, 4 out of 6 of the county commission districts or something like that, some combination. But it's about 70,000. I am not one that's in favor of restricting the ability to petition the government. I mean, if they get 70,000 signatures, that's a lot of signatures to put an issue on the ballot. I think what this fight really is should it be on the ballot? In other words, should you put anything on the ballot, for instance, this tourist development tax, where you're trying to tell the county to put in reserve all the money that's not obligated for bond issues? Well, first of all, you're basically telling the county to escrow dollars that are collected pursuant to a state statute, which I think is unconstitutional. So those kind of issues are getting a little bit, fine-tuned, I suppose, for lack of a better expression. But the question really is not how many signatures it really is. It really is what is the issue trying to put on the ballot. And maybe what the Charter Commission to do is basically say you can't put anything on the ballot that's in conflict with state law or the Constitution, which seems to be...
I think just very briefly that what you really need to do in this area is have less. I think the idea of putting these constitutional amendments really just hasn't been a real plus for the state. Mm-hmm. And I think it can go down. And if you're going to have something, it shouldn't be crammed down your throat at the last minute. You should have time to work on it. So I think in this case, they had to go back to the start and try and figure out what they can do and how it can be. If it is that important, let's just concentrate on that. If that's the one thing that's really critical, let's talk about it and see if we can get some legislation to at least give the people a chance to vote on it.
And I think that's why the legislature went to a 60% requirement that constitutional amendments pass. It used to be 50% plus one, now it's 60%.
And just finally, the primary for State House District 44 is next week, a special election to fill the post vacated by Steve Precourt. Eric Eisenhower is the Republican frontrunner for the seat. Lou Fry, do you see any surprises along the way for...
Well, wouldn't be a lecture without a surprise somewhere along the line. I would assume that Precourt left things pretty well lined up.
Right.
And, you know, there's not a lot to do, not a lot of heavy lifting.
So pretty much open and shut as far as you're concerned?
Well, I don't know, open and shut, but certainly real cracked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he's raised almost $200,000, yeah. Approaching $200,000. Keep in mind, he was a legislator. Eric was a legislator for 4 years, two terms. During reapportionment, they put him head-to-head with Steve Precourt in his district. He decided not to run and let Steve run, and then he would come back and run. And there's always talk about him being speaker material, which is kind of interesting because that would be like 2021 or something like that. But his opponent in the primary has only raised about $2,000. I mean, it's a Republican seat. So
money talks. When you look at the things, forget the polls, look at the money. If they've raised a lot of money and there's something, fine. If they haven't raised any money and they're talking to you, you're probably not worth listening to.
Right.
Dick Batchelor, former Democratic State House Representative and head of the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Very nice speaking with you.
Thank you.
And also Lou Fry, former Republican Congressman and an attorney at Lowndes, Drostick, Doster and Canter and Reed. Very nice speaking to you as well.
Look forward to seeing you in the near future.
Up next, a conversation with SR-71 pilot and keynote speaker at this month's Women in Aviation Conference, Brian Shull. I'm joined on the line now by Brian Shull. He is talking at a Women in Aviation Conference in Orlando. Brian, thank you very much for joining me.
Well, very happy to be here this morning.
So tell me about the conference. What's the substance of the talk going to be?
Well, the Women in Aviation each year invite a variety of interesting speakers for their convention. Some a little more technical on hands-on flying. Some more about job search and opportunities for women in aviation. But they usually have several keynote speakers, of which I'm happy to be one. I had a very interesting and unique flying career in that I actually was one of only 93 men who got to fly the SR-71, the world's fastest, highest-flying spy plane.
Now, the Blackbird, a lot of that, what was secret before, would be unclassified now, I guess?
Well, yes. Most of it has been declassified. And it was shrouded in secrecy for so long. Now it's pretty much declassified, but it's always interesting to get a pilot's perspective on what it was like. But what's added to my talks is that I have an interesting story of my own flying career that I weave into my SR-71 slides, and that is that I was shot down in Vietnam and given up for dead and laying dead in the jungle and came back 13 years later after getting back into flying and everything, and after 15 surgeries, and I was able to pass an astronaut physical to fly the planes.
Well, the plane you were shot down in is obviously quite different from the SR-71. Just explain a little bit about what you were doing when you were flying that plane.
Yeah, very different. I was doing close air support. I was a fighter pilot in the Air Force and just doing close air support near the Cambodian border there, and was unlucky enough to go down near the very end of the war, and we had to ride an airplane into the jungle and blew up and was in a burning aircraft, sustained severe burn injuries, and was lucky enough to be rescued, flown out, and spent 1 year in the hospital and 15 surgeries, and miraculously was able to get back on flying duty, which the Air Force didn't think I would do, and I flew for 12 years in A-7s, A-10s, and did a lot of air show stuff, and volunteered to fly the Blackbird near the end of my career, and it was kind of a big story in the Air Force. I didn't want to be a big story. I just wanted to fly and be able to do my job.
You had to basically pass the kind of test an astronaut would have to go through to get qualified to become an SR-71 pilot.
Yes, very similar, because you are wearing a spacesuit. You're flying up at altitudes near 90,000 feet, and you're wearing the same kind of spacesuit like the space shuttle pilots would wear. So they do put you through a much more comprehensive physical exam. It took 2 days than you would normally do just for a regular flying physical.
So what was it like flying one of these things? You're essentially kind of locked into that little space for quite some time. Just explain what it was like flying a Blackbird.
Well, it's a very 60s cockpit. You're hands-on flying the airplane. It's a two-man crew. The man in the back is doing the primary navigation systems and the camera systems, and your job in front is to fly the airplane, and there's quite a lot of systems to manage and to keep track of, but you're cruising along at 2,000 miles an hour at 88,000 feet, and there's a lot going on, a lot happening. It's a very smooth ride, but you're never a dull moment. You're constantly monitoring the systems, the airplane, make sure it's flying on course precisely, because that's exactly that was critical for the cameras of the airplane to get the intelligence that they needed to gather on that particular mission.
How much assistance was there from computer assistance, that kind of thing, just to keep this plane up in the air and flying smoothly?
Well, you got to remember, this airplane was built in 1962. We didn't even have computers in the airplane when we first got in it. They put three computers in the plane in the 80s, and that was strictly to monitor a system. So as far as aiding you in flying the airplane, not much at all. It was a 60s cockpit and systems, pretty archaic by today's standards, but yet a genius in the way they put it all together to make it work, and it did. It lasted, and it was a viable system that really very little was done to completely upgrade the system, other than the sensors were upgraded all the time. Of course, the ability to photograph the territory below you was always upgraded. But the aircraft itself was your basic 57 Chevy that they didn't really do that much different to over the years.
Did you know a lot about what you were volunteering for when you signed on to lead it, or did they keep some of that secret from the pilots who were to fly this thing?
Well, that's a good question. It was very interesting. When you went out to interview for the job, you really didn't know that much about it, but the interview took 1 week. And in that week, they actually showed you quite a bit. They took you in the simulator, showed you the whole cockpit and a little bit about what they do, put you in a spacesuit, and also you got a very, very good grasp of what you were getting into. And it was a good process, because some people then realized, hey, I don't feel comfortable flying with a space helmet on like this, or that looks like too much, or I'm not interested. But I was surprised how much they really did show you in the interview, although, you know, without giving away any big secrets. So it was very thorough, and it allowed you to have a good handle on, do you really want to do this or not.
You obviously hold a lot of affection still for the Blackbird. It's clearly a pretty amazing machine. Is the Blackbird the pinnacle of aviation as far as you're concerned?
I think it stands as a pinnacle to what it did in its era, and how it was conceived, and it was so far ahead of its time. And still to this day, I do find it remarkable that an aircraft built in 62, now in 2014, still holds every speed and altitude record. So it obviously is at the pinnacle of its class and for what it did. Now, of course, I'm sure someday we'll have, you know, you can build things that go faster and all, but will they be as efficient, effective, and successful a system as the Blackbird was? It's hard to say. Truly the most remarkable aircraft of the 20th century in how it was built, what it did, and how it was able to accomplish that mission successfully, undefeated for a quarter of a century.
Well, Brian Shull, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for your time. I do appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate the interview. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.